Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
In July 1964, the Sunday Mirror ran a front-page story headlined "Peer and a Gangster Yard Inquiry." While the article withheld the names of the subjects, the newspaper reported the Commissioner of Metropolitan Police had ordered an investigation into an alleged homosexual relationship between a household name in the House of Lords and a leading figure in the London Underground. Lord Boothby was the Conservative Lord in question, and Ronnie Cray, the infamous gangster. But the scandal was hushed up. It's the subject of a new book called The Peer and the Gangster. It's by Daniel Smith. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from London. Danny himself, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Take us back, if you will, then, to the early 1960s and how a Conservative peer and one of London's most feared crime lords could actually meet up.
Yeah, the whole story is, it's a bizarre one from start to finish, really. So Boothby was bisexual all of his life. He was married, he ended up being married twice. He'd already been married once at the time of the scandal. He'd also been having an affair with Harold Macmillan's wife, who was then Prime Minister, he resigned the previous year as Prime Minister. He'd had an affair with Macmillan's wife for the past three decades, so he's an eccentric character, to say the least. And in the early 60s, he would frequent all sorts of the more exotic of London's night spots. And at some point in the early 60s, he ended up meeting a man several decades younger than him called Leslie Holt. And Leslie Holt happened to also be a part-time driver for the Crays. So Holt was really the link figure that introduced the pair. And that happened, it's unclear exactly when, but probably sometime around 63 that Boothby first.
And in 1963, whilst everybody is getting in a froth about the Beatles and Profumo and whatever,
exactly.
What stage were the Crays then in their takeover of London?
So they were fairly well advanced by that point. They were very much under the surveillance of the Metropolitan Police. They were aware of their activities. They'd extended their protection rackets. They moved from their base into the East End, into the West End. They owned particularly Swish joint in Mayfair by that time. They'd also started cultivating a lot of the celebrity connections and also some of their political connections, of whom Boothby would be the most prominent at the time. So they were well on the way to their kind of the high point of their career, if you want to call it a high point. But equally, they were not yet household names. So for most people reading that newspaper headline in 64, they probably wouldn't have known who the Craves were off the, you know, top of their heads, although they would certainly have known who Boothby was.
So can and correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it 1967 that homosexuality is decriminalized? So
that's right.
So basically, this is as a story, I mean, it's explosive enough to have a household conservative peer and one of the most feared figures in the underworld consorting together. But the fact that there seems to be a homosexual relationship or homosexual leanings in this as well make it even more explosive.
It would have been absolutely explosive on that basis at the time. As history has proved, and you know, my research has proved, there was not a relationship between Boothby and Cray themselves, but in many ways the story gets even darker, because essentially Ronnie Cray became almost like a pimp, finding young men for Boothby, and they attended parties together. Ronnie Cray had a reputation for hosting parties at which numerous of the guests were there via coercion rather than you know, because they wanted to be. So from a modern perspective as well, that actually the story, you know, today we would think, okay, this is perhaps an unusual relationship, but there's nothing illegal about it. But in fact, it was this question of coercion and drawing other people into the situation against their will that was really the scandal that went undiscovered all this time. But certainly at the time, you know, the very idea of a leading member of the House of Lords and a figure like Cray being in any kind of relationship would have absolutely, to be honest, would have blown the lid off the government at the time, and would have probably outdone Profumo for the volume of scandal that pursued it, really.
Let's go to the paper itself, because it's 1964. Now, the Sunday Mirror was a very different paper to perhaps the Mirror that we know today.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of the, you know, there was the News of the World and the Sunday Mirror, and they really dominated the Sunday breakfast tables of the nation. There were millions and millions of people that paid attention to them. And, you know, in some ways it wasn't so different. It was more of the left-leaning side of the political spectrum, and certainly the editor there and the major figures in the Mirror group at the time would have had an eye on perhaps doing a favour for Harold Wilson and being able to get stuck into the Conservative government with a story like this. But yes, certainly now the newspaper, the reach of the newspapers is not what it was because of the internet, but this was at a time when, you know, the Sunday Mirror was selling millions and millions of copies, and what it said and what it put on its front page really did matter.
So, I mean, how did this story come to the attention of the newspapers, or indeed the attention of the Metropolitan Police?
So the Metropolitan Police had put the Crays under surveillance at the beginning of 64. They had a secret surveillance arm called C-11, and they had watched the Crays closely to see what they were up to. And it was in the course of this surveillance that they picked up on various of the celebrity associations that they had. And Boothby was considered the most prominent political association they had. And at the time, there was a very experienced and respected chief crime reporter on the Sunday Mirror, a chap called Norman Lucas, who was tapped into everything that went on in the Met. He had people who would bring him stories every day, and this one came his way, really dropped into his lap. And he could spot a good story. He knew what a good story was and went with it.
And what was the reaction then to this this front page story when it hit the breakfast tables on a Sunday morning in July 1964?
So there was the inevitable shock. The thing about that first story was that neither Cray nor Boothby were named because there was fear over the libel laws at the time, and the Sunday Mirror wanted to keep building its dossier of evidence effectively. They ran with the story, but they did not name Boothby or Cray. And then the following day, a photographer appeared at the offices of the Mirror saying, "Oh, I saw your story yesterday. I suspect you're referring to this." And he had actually taken photos of Boothby and Cray together at what was ostensibly a business meeting in Boothby's flat, taken earlier in the year. There was then a lot of legal to-ing and fro-ing, and Ronnie Cray was not keen for these photos to be published at the time, and there was a legal injunction, so the Mirror couldn't publish them the next week, but they ran with a front page on the following Sunday in which they described the photos and said, basically with a headline, "The photos that we cannot print." But again, they hadn't yet named Boothby and Cray. Everybody in Westminster knew it was Boothby. Everybody on Fleet Street knew it was Boothby. The population at large still didn't. But then a German magazine did publish their names, and at that point Boothby felt he had to act, and he wrote a letter to the Times basically denying that he was the subject of any of these allegations or that there was any truth in the allegations at all. And it was from there that the cover-up happened very quickly, and really this, what would have been a huge scandal, just faded into the background within a couple of weeks, and it was an extraordinary thing.
Harold Wilson? Harold Wilson was the head of the Labour Party, wasn't he? Yeah. I mean, was he involved with this as well?
He was. It became a cross-party cover-up. Mm. So when the Sunday Mirror published this story, for various reasons, which I detail in the book, the normal process of perhaps checking a story with the Labour hierarchy to make sure they were on board with it as well didn't happen. So the Labour Party did not know this story was going to be published. And as it happened, Boothby had a partner in crime in all of this, who was a chap called Tom Dryburgh, who was a Labour MP.
Dryburgh.
And had indeed been Secretary of the Labour Party as recently as 1958. Chairman of the Labour Party, sorry, as recently as 1958. So immediately the Labour Party were conscious that this might sting them too. And I think there was also an atmosphere post-Profumo, and the year before that is another scandal that we tend to forget about, but there was a spy scandal with a chap called John Vassal that had done the government great damage that year as well. So this was really the third year in a row that there was a potentially quite a devastating sex scandal that threatened the government. And I think Wilson knew that there was going to be an election later in the year. It looks like he was well set to win it. And I think there was fear within the Labour Party that actually if they attached themselves to this this one about Boothby, that it could in fact backfire on them. So the Conservatives and the Labour Party both had good reason for hushing it all up.
I mean, as you say, I mean, if you ever wanted proof of the old boy network springing into effect, because Dryburgh, of course, was you couldn't be openly homosexual, but he was pretty darn close in those days, wasn't he?
He was as near as you could get. His memoirs, which were in fact published after he died in the 70s. Arguably the most explosive political memoir probably of the 20th century in many ways, certainly in terms of personal revelations. So yes, he was again, he amongst those in the know, amongst Westminster and Fleet Street, there was not much secret about Dryburgh's private life. Mm. But it was very effectively kept from the British public for decades.
You have the Old Boy Network closing ranks and closing their story down, but then again, of course, you have the Cray Network closing ranks and closing down. I mean, for one of the Crays to be named, if you like, or as a homosexual, would have been bad enough for those outside, in the East End of which where they are operating. Obviously, the Crays made sure that nobody was going to testify, and come forward.
Indeed, yeah. They certainly... Ronnie Cray was an interesting character on this because he was openly homosexual with those within his circle. It wasn't a lifestyle he hid from everybody, but it certainly wasn't something that, you know, the aspiring lord of the crime underworld would want splashed across the papers, certainly. And yes, such was the threat that they just intrinsically held over people, that there was no one going to be coming forward. I mean, in the case of the photographer who brought the photos to the Mirror on that Monday morning, he very quickly regretted that decision and was soon backtracking and trying to reclaim the photos, because you know that he was really the only person in that first week who stuck his head above the parapet, and Cray immediately put the squeeze on that he ought to rethink. So, yeah.
Not a good position to be in, I would think.
No.
Of course, Boothby ended up, you know, rather than denying, ended up suing the Mirror, and you know, there were the editor, I believe, was fired.
Yep, the editor was fired, and he was sent off to edit a very low-ranking magazine somewhere else in the Mirror Group for the rest of his career. Boothby not only went to sue, he didn't even have to go to court. He got an out-of-court settlement of £40,000, which would be probably somewhere in the region of 800,000 to a million today, a huge amount of money. It was a record payout at the time. And he also got a front page apology on the Sunday Mirror. And he was aided and abetted in all of this by a chap called Lord Goodman, who was probably the most successful media lawyer in the country at that time, and Gerald Gardner, who was a barrister and a QC, who were central to Harold Wilson's team of advisors. So Boothby, in the end, got bailed out by Harold Wilson's main legal henchman, which is another intriguing and strange aspect of the story. It just shows you how deep there was this cross-party concern that the story should go away.
So why did you think... Well, how did you start investigating this story, and why did you think it was, you know, the time was right to have another look at this quite unbelievable affair?
Yeah, it was a very funny one for me. About 10 years ago, I was invited to write a history of the Dig for Victory campaign in the Second World War, and that, which was a jolly, you know, it was a really nice book to write. It was basically a very jolly story about, you know, good people doing good things, and Lord Boothby came onto my radar for the first time. I was born in the 70s, you know, I didn't really know much about Lord Boothby, but writing this book was the first time I'd heard about him, because he was one of the junior ministers at the Ministry of Food during the Second World War. So I had a little delve into his background, and then I started, 10 years ago, I started coming across this information that there had been this association with the Crays, which rather seemed out of keeping with everything else that I knew about him. So I'd always kept an eye on, you know, was there any more of the story coming out? Then in 2015, there was a release of MI5 files, basically, in the National Archives that dealt with sort of key aspects of the scandal. So that really reignited my interest in it. And in the way of writers, I quickly had a look on Amazon to see if anybody else had written a book on all of this yet, and I was surprised that nobody had. So I thought, you know, I think this really needs a bit more looking into. And the more I delved, the more extraordinary the story became, and I became, you know, absolutely fixed on it for the last two and a half years, and the book is the result.
And I mean, it does capture a particular time in London. I mean, it's before, if you like, the swinging 60s really kicks into gear, but it's an interesting phase when, you know, it was a very small social circle, if you like, and which was soon to change, and, you know, Wilson would come into power and make it perhaps a more egalitarian sort of society, but, you know, you had you know, peers rubbing shoulders with gangsters and all the echelons of that rank of society getting involved.
Yeah, and I think it was just at that turning point where it was still possible to have cover-ups of this sort, where you had certain strata of society all absolutely aware of what was going on and then everybody else being kept in the dark. I think that's very hard to do. For instance, now in the age of social media, you know, I think it would be impossible to engineer this kind of cover-up, but we were at that tipping point where it was still possible.
I'm just thinking how dangerous it would be if you tried to take a selfie with one of the Cray twins, but there you go.
Yeah.
What happened? I mean, we know what happened to the Crays eventually, even though they were at that point. But at that time in London, and this, because Boothby stood up for them, didn't he? He did it. He stood up for them in the House of Lords and did a speech to get them off.
Yeah, they basically had him over a barrel, really. And I should say, you know, I find Boothby a very conflicting figure because in many ways, you know, he was often on the right side of history politically. You know, he was there with Churchill in the 30s, an ardent anti-appeaser. He was very for European Union in the 50s. He fought very hard for reform of the law in relation to homosexuality. So, you know, he did a lot of good and interesting things in his career. And it was very sad that by this time the Crays basically had him over a barrel and they were arrested in 65 for an unrelated protection racket, on the charges to do with an unrelated protection racket. And Boothby basically completely went against what he should have been doing and made a speech in the House of Lords trying to get them out on bail whilst they were being held prior to their trial. And it was just it was humiliating for him. He shouldn't have had to have done it. But in a way, he was an old fool by that point, and he got himself into a situation he should have certainly have realised much, much earlier what he was dealing with by consorting with the Crays. But by then it was too late, and you know, he had to do this kind of rather humiliating sticking up for them, and it was sad.
Mm.
It was really sad.
And did this, I mean, although the affair was never sort of published, etc., I mean, was that pretty much the decline of Boothby's influence in political circles?
Yeah, I mean, by that time he was in the House of Lords, so he'd been in Parliament for 35-odd years, and in his earlier days, you know, people really did see him as a potential future Prime Minister. He'd been personal private secretary to Churchill and all this kind of stuff. By the 60s, he was in the Lords, and he was older, and really the political boat had sailed, but he'd been a major, he was really the first politician to become a TV and radio celebrity. So the year before, he'd featured on This Is Your Life as one of the subjects, and he was always on TV and radio. He had an incredibly sort of velvety baritone voice, which probably, you know, most people in the country could have recognised instantly. So he was still influential in those terms. And he carried on having a media presence, but I would say he was a diminished figure afterwards. And certainly because most people in the media knew what the score was, really. And so I don't think he ever had that same credibility and gravitas, really.
The book is called The Peer and the Gangster, a very British cover-up. It's by Dan Smith. It's out now with the History Press. Dan, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, where can they go? Would you have a website?
I've got a WordPress website, which is Dan Smith Writer, and I also have Twitter tag, which is Dan Smith _ Writer.
And after doing The Peer and the Gangster, what are you up to next?
Well, I'm in the process trying to decide that. I'll be honest with you, it's a hard story to follow. I like the combination of crime and politics, I have to say. I think that always makes for good stories. I had a couple of ideas, but I'm still milling them around, so I might have to come back to you on that one.
Well, we look forward to welcoming you back on the programme when you do. This is an excellent book. It's called The Peer and the Gangster, a very British cover-up. It's by Dan Smith. Dan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Springhill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.